There is something ingrained in humans which makes us never satisfied. We want what we can't have, and the grass is always greener. But is it about the greener grass or the path that we take to find it?
You know, the quote that really stuck with me while I was out there was the Amelia Earhart quote, "It's good to have an end to the journey, but it's the journey that matters in the end."
We all have journeys of our own. Maybe they aren't as extreme as traveling across the entire Atlantic Ocean in a rowboat. But that doesn't mean we can't learn from it. Welcome to the podcast that explores the minds of those who explore. Welcome to Mountain Meister.
Who are the Mountain Meisters?
Committing to the goal and galvanizing you and your team behind that one single focus.
Being at peace with that fear and being okay with it.
You gain a real appreciation for your life and for what you have.
Learn about their extreme lives on Rock, Snow, and Ice with your host, Ben Schenk.
Hi, everyone. Before we welcome our guest today, just a quick note. As of this episode's release, the marathon is this weekend, this Sunday, November 2nd. If you would like to track my struggle, you can do it on the Marathon app. New York City Marathon has an app where you can type in my bib number. My bib number is 17831. That's posted to all of our social platforms. Also, I was recently featured on the Diz Runs With podcast. Diz is Denny Cray, and we chat about all sorts of things. We talk a little bit about Mountain Meister, running, the marathon coming up, and everything in between. I'll have a sample at the end of this episode, and you can listen to the whole thing. I'll have the links posted on our website. Also, check out Denny's podcast, Diz Runs With, on SoundCloud, iTunes, however you listen to podcasts. Okay, back to the show. Hello, everyone. Hello, Meister fans. Welcome to another episode. Today on the show, we welcome Deborah Searle. Deborah, hi. Say hi to all the Meister fans out there. How are you doing today?
Hi. Hello from England.
Hello from England. I'm on the east coast of the US, so right across the Atlantic Ocean from you.
Yeah, that's actually quite a long way.
Yeah, it is a long way. You know a little bit about the Atlantic Ocean. We'll get there. Deborah, for almost all of the incredible people we host on this show, there's one question that really gets the listeners to know you. Whether it's, you know, a ultra marathon or running 100 miles in a single race, or a mountaineer that's going to 8,000 meter peaks where the oxygen is low, or in your case, rowing in a rowboat across the Atlantic Ocean, 3,300 miles. And that question is, what could possibly possess you to do something like this? So I think we need to know a little bit more about who you were before you did this incredible thing. So tell us a little bit about who you were and what possessed you to row across the Atlantic Ocean.
For me, the obsession started when I was about 14. I went to a school on the edge of a national park called Dartmoor in Devon. And it was the type of school where they threw you out on the weekend with a rucksack on your back. And I got really into the whole, you know, hill walking, mountaineering, kayaking thing, 14, 15 years old. And it just became an obsession. So, you know, all my friends were into Spice Girls and all of that stuff at the time. And I was just reading all these books by explorers and adventurers who'd gone to the poles or had climbed Everest. Oh. And made a decision at that point that as a career, I wanted to become a professional adventurer. And I even told my careers advisor that at school. And of course, she laughed at me and said, "Don't be ridiculous. That's not a career for a young lady." But for over 12 years now, the title underneath my name on my business card has read professional adventurer.
Professional adventurer. How do you make a living as a professional adventurer?
Well, the way it works is I have a couple of companies that I run that are related to the things we do. So the expeditions in themselves bring in an income. Then we do media partnership deals. So often the BBC will come along and film them and make TV programs out of them. We do media deals also with newspapers and magazines and write blogs and things. And the other side of it, of course, is what a lot of adventurers do, is the motivational speaking side and running workshops. Ours spreads a little bit further than that. And now we've started to use the expeditions to work with companies in particular on the issue of gender diversity. And we work with companies who are getting a bit stuck on the issue of how to get women further up their organization and into the senior management roles. So we're doing a great project at the moment with one company on that, where we're taking a team of their women to do a traverse of Baffin Island in the Arctic Circle next year. So we have quite a few different revenue streams. There needs to be quite a few because, of course, it's cyclic in a way. You know, you can't be out on expedition all the time. So there has to be different revenue streams for why you're not away doing the fun bit.
Very interesting. You know, honestly, when I saw that you rode across the Atlantic Ocean, I figured that you had a midlife crisis beforehand.
And yeah, I was only about 25, so it was too soon for that.
The quarter life crisis. So you have the honor, Deborah, of being the first ocean rower on this podcast, which means just like the first splitboarder or the first freestyle kayaker or the first ultra marathoner, we need to learn how you even possibly do this. To start off, I didn't even know that ocean rowing existed. Do other people do this besides you?
Yeah, well, I mean, I did the Atlantic Race quite a few years, over 10 years ago now. But the way it started was two British men, John Ridgway and Sir Che Blyth, rode the North Atlantic in 1966. And then somewhere in the, the mid late 90s, Che Blyth decided that he wanted to try and run it as a race. But he did love to tell everyone that more people had been to the moon than had rode across the ocean and survived. So there was a lot of uncertainty. And so when he started this concept of an Atlantic rowing race, which went from the Canary Islands just off the coast of Africa across the Atlantic and finished in Barbados, that was a real unknown. And there was a great excitement about, you know, will we make it? Will we live? And so most people, if they are going to get involved with that, now do it through that channel of that race, because you know, often there's about 30 double-handed rowing boats that will take part, and they have a couple of support yachts that kind of dot across the Atlantic, checking that boats are okay, and they're polling them all by sat position and stuff. And there's like any race, there's a number of rules, like you can't take outside assistance, you have to carry all your own equipment and supplies and food, and there's now also, it's branched out, and there's a Pacific race now. So if you want to go from California to Hawaii, I think there's a race going next June.
Interesting. So you say all this stuff, it almost sounds like it's not an adventure. Is it an adventure or a race?
Well, for me, it was very much an adventure because I was disqualified from the race when my partner had to be rescued. We were taking part in a double-handed race, but my husband, who I was rowing with, got incredibly ill and had to be rescued very early on. And that was deemed to be breaking one of the rules of taking outside assistance.
Let me just stress to the listeners here really quickly how difficult this is. 2 weeks into the expedition, Deborah's husband got incredibly ill, like she said, and had to leave. Deborah was left by herself to finish this race if she chose to do so, which you did, Deborah. And it ended up taking how long?
Well, Andrew and I had planned it to take 6 weeks, but on my own, it took 3.5 months. And that whole time, I saw the rescue yacht came to visit me once just before Christmas. But the rest of the time, I was completely alone. I didn't have a boat following me. And so for me, when you ask the question, was it a race or is it an adventure? For me, it was absolutely an adventure. And it ceased to become about the race even before Andrew got off the rowing boat. The journey was becoming such a life-changing experience that it really didn't matter where I came in the race.
111 days, 3,300 miles, if our listeners were wondering. Let's talk about the boat before we get into some heavier topics. Tell us just a little bit about what you were living in for those 3 months.
Yeah, so they're changing now, but at that time I went in a rowing boat that came as part of the challenge, so that it arrived as 24 sheets of marine plywood, looked like a box, like an IKEA wardrobe. I don't know if you've IKEA there.
Although it's a little bit higher quality than an IKEA wardrobe, right?
And it was, so it was just 6 millimeter thick plywood that was laser cut into pieces, into sections. We needed to build it as part of the challenge. So it was 24 foot long. It's about 1.5 meters wide. It's a totally open boat, except for at one end, there's a kind of coffin shaped pod, like a cabin that if it's really stormy, you can get inside there and shut the hatch down and roll around, and it's watertight and airtight. And then there's a load of water ballast in the bottom of the boat. And effectively, if you've got that coffin shaped pod, if you've got the hatch shut, and that's like an air pocket that's high up on the boat, if you get hit and knocked over by a wave, the boat in theory should roll straight back up again, because wow. of the ballast, you know, needing to get back down to the bottom and the air pocket bubbling to the top.
Did that ever happen to you?
No, it didn't. The boats are really incredibly designed in that, you know, I got hit by some massive waves and the boat went right over on its side on so many occasions. But then the wave would either break over the top of me or go underneath me and I'd kind of flop back down the other way. And I grew to have enormous confidence in the boat and just felt incredibly safe on it, which was probably, now looking back, was quite foolish. I made a lot of foolish decisions because I really trusted this little boat.
Hmm. Interesting. And I also read that the boat was outfitted with solar panels.
Yeah, that's how I survived. I had four different solar panels, and that charged a car battery, and then the car battery ran a water maker. So I sucked up seawater through the bottom of the boat, desalinated it, converted it to fresh water, and then I mixed that purified seawater with freeze-dried food that was all packed into the hull of the boat. And then I had a tiny little gas stove that I cooked it up on.
Where's your boat now?
I kept it for quite a few years. I was really emotionally attached to it. I was struggling with the concept of getting rid of it. And then two young guys approached me and said they wanted to buy it to try and break the Atlantic record of 42 days and raise money for cancer research, a big Wow. charity here in the UK. And my father had died of cancer just before the row, and my mother at the time had breast cancer. So it just felt like the right thing for the boat to go to.
Wow, very cool. Well, that was good of you. Did the boat have a name?
Yeah, I called it my Ickle Floaty Boat.
Your Ickle Floaty Boat.
No one's ever asked me that before. I feel quite embarrassed admitting
it. It's not nearly as elegant as some other boats' names, but I like it.
Yeah. It should be, you know, Destroyer or Discoverer or something like that, shouldn't it?
Okay, so let's move on to stuff that maybe will hopefully evoke some goosebumps on the part of our listeners. Let's talk about when your husband left you in the middle of the ocean. I'm sure that the British tabloids had fun with that one. Mm-hmm. What was your reaction when this started happening? Like, did you know immediately when you saw him sick that he was not going to complete this thing?
Yeah, you know, we'd spent 4 years of our life preparing for this race. So for us, it had been our everything. We were massively in debt. We put all our money into this, about 80,000 pounds, maybe $140,000 we'd spent on it. And so, you know, for us, the dream was always to do it together. But from the first night, it was very apparent that the issue for him was that he had a massive phobia of open ocean. And we had stupidly done all of our training on the River Thames in London. So we had no knowledge that would be an issue. And because he's 6'5" and he'd rowed kind of top international level, we just presumed that for him it wouldn't be an issue to be out there. But of course, the ocean is very different to rowing on flat lakes and rivers, which is where, you know, his competitive rowing in eights was all done. And as soon as the waves, we had a big storm on the first night, and as soon as the waves started breaking over the boat and we were in the pitch black and just couldn't even see the lights on land anymore, that was when we realized that for him, this was not just a bit of a kind of, this is uncomfortable to me. It was much more than that. And got worse and worse as the days went on, and he found it very difficult to do the basics of eating or sleeping. Was very difficult for him because he was having panic attacks quite often. And so his physical condition then got worse and worse. And by night seven, I found him that night, and it was like he was slipping in and out of consciousness. He just couldn't respond to me at all. And I suppose that for me was the defining moment when I thought, this race is over for us. We've got to get him back to dry land.
Wow. So some people actually, if you talk about people stranded at sea, don't have the option to leave the boat. What do you think would have happened if he didn't have that option to leave?
Gosh, do you know what? I've never even thought about that. I mean, I initially we thought he'd get used to it, and we really held on to that hope. But to see him get worse and worse over those days, I suppose I couldn't even comprehend that he'd be able to stay out there, because to be unconscious, it didn't seem like there was as much worse than that. Than, you know, the next step would be death, you know. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't even comprehend the thought of him staying out there. But I wonder partly whether that's a reflection on mentally, when you know that there is rescue at hand,
and right, exactly.
You're able to kind of go to that place, and I'm, in many ways, I wonder whether his kind of mind and body just was able to give up effectively, because he knew that a rescue could get to him.
Exactly, it's a really interesting thing to think about. On that topic of, you know, stranded at sea, two books, and I guess a book/movie, Life of Pi and Unbroken. Have you read Unbroken by Laura Hillenbrand?
Oh, I must read that. A few people have mentioned it to me recently, but the Life of Pi one was for me just incredible to watch, because so many of the scenes were, you know, identical to the things that happened to me at sea, and it was quite weird watching it. You know, the bit where that he was being pelted by flying fish. I mean, that was a daily occurrence for me. You know, and so someone to capture it, and I could like feel the fish scales on me again, and feel how much it hurts when a really big one hit me in the top of my arm, because it gave me a dead arm for a week. And you know, it just was, and seeing all the phosphorescence, the way they captured that in the film was very accurate. So it was wonderful for just like a, you know, big step down memory lane for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And for our listeners, you can see both of those resources on Deborah's Meister profile page. Unbroken, I know people have told you to read it. I'll be another one to tell you to read it.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. If there is one, I mean, we have a lot of book recommendations on this show. This is my book recommendation for the Meister fans, Unbroken by Laura Hillenbrand. It is unbelievable. Okay. And for you too, Deborah.
And did you say that's a film now?
I think they're making it into a film. Not quite sure, but I'm pretty sure I heard that through the grapevine.
Okay, oh, great.
Mm-hmm. But the difference between what you're doing and what these people are doing is that they are stranded at sea, and you had the option. You chose to do this. And that brings up the question, is this selfish on your part? Did you feel guilty during this trip?
Do you know, the funny thing was, when I was out there, I didn't feel at all guilty. It just didn't even strike me as something I should feel guilty about. The moment it hit me was when I was rowing towards Barbados. I was a few miles off the coast, and a speedboat was flying out towards me with my family and my shore team on the boat. And it was the moment I looked at my mum. That's when it hit me, that because my dad had just died before, and she'd had that whole time alone, lying in bed at nights thinking, I've no idea if she's dead or alive now out there. And it was seeing this kind of relief on her face that made me think, oh my goodness, what have I put her through in these last 3.5 months of hell? And I selfishly didn't consider that. I only ever thought about me and how hard it was for me out there. So I look at my expeditions in a very different way now, and of course even more different because I now have two little girls of my own, and so I'm on the other side of it.
How do you balance that? I mean, you and many of the people we have on this show just have this incredible need for adventure and for doing these kinds of things that could seemingly be selfish. How do you balance doing those activities versus, you know, being careful and watching out for other people?
Well, I mean, I suppose the way I rationalize it is, for me, it's a job. It's been my job for 12 or 13 years now. And I'm very conscious of the statistics that I'm more likely to get run over by a bus. You know, crossing the street in England is far more dangerous. So, you know, statistically, I know I'm more likely to get hurt in other ways. The other thing, I suppose, is that I'm very conscious that the selfishness, it doesn't seem that way to me a lot of the time, because this is how I provide for my family. This is how I pay my bills. And if I was a soldier who was away at war for 2 months, or if I was a business person who, you know, I have a lot of friends who work in London where they leave for the office at 6:30 in the morning, they get home at 7:30 in the evening, and they only see their children on the weekends. So it may seem to be a dangerous lifestyle that seems quite selfish, but I think it's no different to a lot of people who have to pay their bills.
That's a really good point. And I think it's something that a lot of people just don't see because people don't look into it closely enough. Good point there. Let's go into something. You had a really good TED Talk, which I'll also post to your Meister profile page. And you talked about choosing your attitude in that. And I think that, I mean, that's obviously something that worked for you on the boat. And it's something that everybody that is listening to this show can take with them. Talk a little bit about like how you choose your attitude and how that helped you there and it does outside of the boat.
Yeah, it happened on a day when I'd nearly been run over by a big, great big container ship, and I was hysterical, and I rang up, I've got an identical twin sister who project manages this, and so I rang up Haley, and I was kind of sobbing down the phone at her and saying, I can't do this on my own. And she said to me, oh, for goodness sake, Deborah, just choose your attitude. And I thought, if you were here now, I would punch you for saying that. And she'd just been on some stupid management training course and learned this, of course, and, you know, it just really struck me that the more I thought about it, nothing else out there I actually had a choice about. I'd often think about the things that were my issues, my dangers, you know, being run over or being attacked by a shark or being run over by, you know, container ships or being washed out the boat by a wave and then not being able to swim fast enough to catch up with it. You know, all of those things were things actually most of the time were quite outside my control. But the one thing that I did have in my control was that I could always choose the attitude with which I responded to those dangers and those problems. And I ended up turning it into a little exercise so that I could do it on a daily basis. And to remind me to do it, I put a visual trigger, which was just I wrote choose your attitude on the bulkhead of the boat, which I looked at every day. And then I'd stop by the bulkhead at breakfast time and after my first 2-hour rowing shift, and I would say it out loud to myself. Come on, Deborah, choose your attitude. Which one is it going to be today? And I'd make myself pick an attitude, which of course had to be positive.
Today's really going to suck.
Yeah, exactly. That was not allowed. So it would be things like, you know, today's attitude is optimism or enthusiasm or, you know, joy. I'm going to try and find joy in things I wouldn't necessarily have. And then the next, once I'd picked one, I would then list out loud all the reasons I had for that one. Like, what would be the benefits? So if it was like, you know, enthusiasm, I'd think, well, I'd list and say, well, if I was being enthusiastic, I'd probably pull harder, which means I'd cover more miles in this 24 hours. Or I might learn, you know, if I'm being enthusiastic about my 2-hour rowing shift when I do my Spanish lesson, because I had this stupid Spanish CD course, I might learn a few more verbs today. Or so I'd kind of justify it to myself why it would be worth picking that attitude. And generally, by the end of breakfast, that's how I would feel. And it would also stop me running the other attitude, the other list, which is all the stuff I either hate or don't want to do or want to be different. And that's why I still use this on the way to work now, because, you know, I catch myself if I didn't do the choose your attitude thing, sitting there thinking, oh, you know, I hate this. I hate drinking this purified seawater, and I want to sleep in a bed that's still for a whole 8 hours. And, you know, I want some more toilet roll because I'd run out and I was using my sock, you know, and it was really desperate out there. But by somehow forcing myself to choose my attitude and be conscious of that and then list the reasons and the benefits for picking that one and sticking with it for the day, I at least started the day in the right way. So now I've got new little verbal, either verbal or visual triggers, depending on where I'm working. So when I lock my car when I've driven to work and press the key fob, it goes beep, beep. And that's my trigger now. And I try and park as far away from the office door as possible so they've got the walk across the car park to pick the attitude and then list the reasons why.
That's cool. That's a good idea, like a little signal to...
Yeah.
And then you give yourself time to think about it too.
Yeah, because unless you've got a trigger, something that reminds you to do it, you just don't do it. And it's great theory, but, you know, you have to act it out.
Very cool. So moving on a little bit, we spoke to Darcy Piku, who is one of the world's best female ultra marathoners. We had a really good talk with her, and something that caught me off guard. So I'm training for this marathon, Deborah, and actually, by the time this episode is released, I may have, in fact, finished the marathon.
Woo! Congratulations!
Well, maybe. Hopefully everything went okay, and I'm still alive. But I was talking to Darcy about how when I finish my long training runs, like 15, 18 miles, I feel like I can't go any further. And I'm like, how am I supposed to do another 10 miles after this? It just doesn't seem possible. And then her reaction to that was when she does 50-mile races, which, I mean, aren't comparable to my 15-milers, but whatever. She says that she feels like she can't go any further after those when she, for her career, does multiple 100-mile races. So my point here is that expectations and how we approach different things can make a huge impact on what the result is. So what were your expectations going into this race? And you, I assume that you expected to finish with your husband. How did your expectations change and impact you along the way?
Yeah, I mean, you know, totally changed. And the thing that had to constantly change all the way through was my expectation of how long I was going to be out there, because there was nothing to compare it to. You know, nobody'd really done this before. And the weather conditions are so different every year. You know, I had two hurricanes while I was out there, and the whole point of going at the time of year I went was it's supposed to be outside of hurricane season. So that it was very hard to know whether it would be 6 weeks that I planned as Andrew, you know, and I were going to do, or a bit longer. I mean, I never, ever could have envisaged when Andrew left that day that it was going to be another 3.5 months. I think had I known that when he left the boat,
you'd have quit.
I would have quit.
Wow. Yeah.
There's no way I would have carried on. And for me, mentally, the real challenge was, and I think this is the problem for when we've got our, you know, we're all pull, I don't know what watches you use, you know, we use a lot of polar watches with our heart rates and our timings. And, you know, we've got all this information around us. And I had that with my GPS. It had distance miles to go to Barbados. And it was often like, you know, 2,176 miles. And then underneath it had, you know, average speed at this moment, 1.2 nautical miles an hour. And it was really hard not to do that maths and think, well, if I'm only going 1.2 and I've got over 2,000 miles to go, I'm going to be out here months and months, and not knowing that whether that was accurate, but you know, and also knowing it was going to change when the next gust of wind came. You know, there was so much unknown about it that it, essentially for me, it became about how do you find ways to just keep going towards that next line of latitude. You know, you can't even think beyond that. You can't even think about the Barbados, the island bit of it. That is so far away from where you are now. So, you know, each line of latitude was a great celebration for me.
Cool. And I'm wondering if we look on the flip side, had you finished, or when you finished in Barbados, if somebody told you you had to do it again right after that, we're going to fly you back, you have to do it again, would you have been able to?
Yeah, I would have gone straight away. And in fact, I actually was approached by Sir Che Blyth, the guy who organized the race, and immediately put to me the idea, would you now go solo around the world nonstop the wrong way against the prevailing winds and tides in a yacht? And so we immediately started working on that campaign, which didn't actually come to fruition because I got beaten to it. The world first was taken by another woman. But I was kind of basically agreeing to head out for what would be even longer. It was going to be about 6 months alone at sea, going in a much tougher place. I was going to go around the Southern Ocean, around Antarctica on my own in a yacht. But I think I just adapted so much the other way. You know, that little boat and living out there became my world. And in many ways, what the world on dry land became one I didn't know anymore.
You need podcasts on these expeditions. You definitely need to listen to podcasts. That will help you get through it.
It would be really different doing it now because, you know, back then we didn't have podcasts, and I didn't have my pod, or, you know, so I didn't have direct communication other than satellite phones. So it would be very, very different. I'd feel a lot less lonely, I think, if I did it now. Mm.
So moving on to something that we like to ask all of our guests, Deborah, is for a gear recommendation. You told me before the show that you are preparing for an expedition in the South Pole. Tell us just quickly a little bit about that and then the gear that you need.
Yeah, so we're taking a team of women up to the Arctic Circle.
The other way.
Baffin Island in April next year, which is really exciting, really looking forward to that project. And I've been trying out some harnesses recently, and one of the companies over is a UK-based company called Snow Sled. That's all one word, snowsled.com. and they've got a great harness. And although it's a waist harness, it also has some really nice shoulder straps as well. And I've found that being able to distribute the weight a little bit more over my whole upper body has been great.
Very neat. We will throw that, the snow sled, on your Meister profile page, Deborah. Thank you for that. To wrap things up, I have one more question for you. I'm curious, a lot of mountaineers talk about how, you know, the summit is the ultimate goal and people really do work for it, but also the ultimate goal is staying alive. And if you think about it, the summit is only one fraction of the entire project. I mean, compared to all of the climbing that you have to do. I'm curious, how would your life be different today had you, you know, you rode across the Atlantic but didn't make it to the finish line?
It's hard to answer that because there's a personal answer, but then there's the external press answer.
Right. Well, let's go personally.
Yeah, I think personally it wouldn't have made any difference because, you know, the quote that really stuck with me while I was out there was the Amelia Earhart quote, "It's good to have an end to the journey, but it's the journey that matters in the end." And I really felt that it was this journey that I'd gone on that had just been so life-changing for me, that had given me so many tools and techniques and strategies for how to stay motivated that I was forced to find in order to keep going, and that have become such a huge part of the way I live my life now, that it wouldn't have mattered whether I'd made it because those lessons were learnt anyway. And that's what's really changed my life.
Awesome, awesome. Deborah, thank you so much for joining us today on Mountain Meister. Fantastic having you. For our listeners, you can find the resources and highlights and a great quote from Deborah. Deborah, you said something amazing on this show today, and we're going to have it on your Meister profile page. Check that out, our website, mtnmeister.com. You can also find out everything you need to know about Deborah at Deborah Searle, S-E-A-R-L-E. .com. Deborah, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Meister fans. Thanks for listening to that episode with Deborah Searle, the lovely Deborah Searle. You heard me say at the beginning of this episode that I chatted with Denny from the Diz Runs podcast. I leave you today with an excerpt from that interview. You can check out the whole thing at DizRuns.com. You can also find other episodes there. He chats with amateurs like me or professionals about running, life, and everything in between. So I was in, this is a funny story. It's not inspirational by any means.
Funny ones are just as good. I love a good funny story.
Okay, good. So it was at the beginning of my training, and it was in the middle of the summer. And I guess I'll preface this by saying, like, I have this – there's some weird problem that I have where I don't know if it's a digestive problem, but I do throw up, like, a lot. And it happens mainly toward the end of the runs when I, like, know how close the finish line is. Mm-hmm. And I have no idea what causes this, but there's definitely some evidence there with when I know where the finish line is and I start to approach it random. I don't know if I like subconsciously pick up my pace and then I like have this 5 second period where I can decide to slow down and not throw up or just keep going and it inevitably comes. And a lot of times in races, I'll just embrace it because after I throw up, I feel fine.
Right.
Just do it gracefully. anyway, so I'm running in the middle of Boston and it was probably like a 7 mile or something along those lines. And I was feeling fine, like really beautiful day. It was pretty warm outside. And I reach this intersection I'm approaching this intersection in Boston. It's Boylston Street and Mass Ave, which are two of probably like these are two main streets in Boston, perhaps like one of the busiest intersections, Boylston and Mass Ave. Mm-hmm. And for people who run in the cities, it's awful when the light turns red and like the cars start going and you have to stop or like switch direction. So I always try to beat the light. So I'm approaching this intersection and like this synergy of one, the light turns yellow, two, I know that I'm approaching the finish line. And then as I know I'm approaching the finish line, this gag reflex comes up. So I have to decide whether or not I'm going to try to beat the light, because I hate having to stop. And then, or two, I'm going to slow down, stop, and not throw up. So split second decision, I decide to sprint past the light. And as I do this...